It's really good to see some folks. Really good to see Diane back with us this morning after a number of weeks not being able to be with us. Good to have you. It's also good to see Elise back from Peru after a number of weeks over there. It's great to have you guys back with us. Well, we're going to continue in Luke chapter 19 as we continue our studies through Luke. Do have the Bible's open in front of you so you can see what I'm saying and where it's coming from. Who do you listen to? Who do you willingly submit to? Who has authority over you? I imagine if I was to ask those questions to many, the answer would be, I only really listen to myself, maybe family and friends. I don't submit to anyone willingly, and no one has any authority over me. I do what I want to do. Of course, yeah, I recognize that I sit under some authority, like my boss or the government, but that's kind of accepted to a degree as a necessary evil. As long as they don't impinge upon my rights, upon who I am, who I want to be, who I identify as, I have all authority. An authority in our culture, when it's put upon us or comes over us, is something we bristle against. It's the very word we don't like. And yet, there is one person's authority we need to sit up to and respond to. Because failure to do so has the most profound consequences. Have a look with me at chapter 19 and verses 45 to 48. And we see his authority demonstrated. See, the king has arrived in Jerusalem. He enters his temple and he begins to drive out those selling within it. There would have been numerous merchants in those temple courts selling various items, animals, wine, oil, salts, doves, all things necessary for traveling pilgrims who have come up to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices to be able to obtain such things to sacrifice. There would have been money exchangers, exchanging Roman and Greek coins into the half shekel required for the temple tax as per the Mosaic law. And every transaction had a built-in charge which generated a huge stream of revenue for the temple, for the priests, for the leaders, for the high priest and his family. And Jesus begins to drive out these sellers. It wasn't so much that these sellers were there, in part they were necessary for traveling pilgrims. It was the naked profiteering of those who were selling, who had stopped being concerned ultimately with helping people worship God. It was all about making money. It was all about the status and the wealth for the leaders. They were more concerned with revenue than they were with God. See, look what Jesus says as he drives them out. He quotes two Old Testament prophets, verse 46. The first is Isaiah 56, verse 7. It says, "My house will be a house of prayer." Or in Isaiah, it says, "My house will be a house of prayer for the nations." And in the context of Isaiah, it foretells a time of God's salvation and it pictures God's temple being thrown open to foreigners, to all peoples of all nations, becoming a place of praise on his holy mountain, Jerusalem, bringing joy to all those who prayed and who offered sacrifices in the temple. And it was a picture of peace between man and God, as things ought to be. And Jesus' arrival at the temple ought to have been welcomed. He would have made the temple everything that had been promised in Isaiah. A great picture of salvation, of men worshipping and praising God as things should be. Of the peace between man and God that he spoke of in verse 42. But instead, Jesus finds that the corruption against which the prophet Jeremiah had pronounced during the days of the exile, where God had accused Israel even then of making his temple a den of robbers, literally a cave of thieves. And it happened again. Corruption had taken hold. Instead of praise, it was the jingling of coins and the bleating of animals. Instead of prayer, it was profit. And Jesus' actions were not a moment of rashness. It wasn't that something just suddenly flicked. His actions were pregnant with meaning. Jesus is establishing his authority. Everything that caused Jesus to speak against the Jews and weep for them in verses 40 to 42 was just as he said. If only they had known, verse 42. If only they had known what on this day would bring you peace. Him. His arrival to his temple. As foretold. But they failed to see. Blinded by their corrupt ways. And so as God's king, he upholds God's honor. He stages, in effect, a coup in the temple. He's kicking out the old system and its evil and dishonoring ways of worship. And he then holds court. Every day, he's teaching the people the truth. We're not told what he's teaching, but presumably, in particular, as we're told in chapter 20, verse 1, he proclaiming the good news. And in light of his actions in the temple, presumably he's teaching about one who he is and why he's come. He's teaching them what it is to truly worship God. That it won't be through a physical temple or through animal sacrifices, but by coming to him, the temple of God. That through his upcoming death and resurrection, he would bear the punishment for our sin, our rejection of God, our choosing to worship in our way. But through him alone, we can have salvation and peace with God. We can have that which Isaiah foretold. Worshipping God as he intended in ways that honored and pleased him. This is the one who has God's authority to forgive sins and bring peace. This is the one. And he's demonstrating and establishing his authority as God's king. And the question's raised, will you submit to it? Will you submit to the one with such authority? See, the leaders understand what's happening. They understand that Jesus' actions are a coup, that he's establishing his authority, that he's opposed to their ways. And they plot to kill him. See that verse 47? And they're only restrained by the adoration of the people. If only they knew. If only they knew what this day could have brought. But instead they continue their murderous ways. And rather than submit to such authority, they begin to challenge his authority. So you have a look at chapter 20 in verses 1 to 8. Jesus teaching in the temple courts, he's proclaiming the good news, verse 1. And the chief priests and the teachers of the law, together with the elders, this is pretty much the elite of Jewish leadership. And they come up to him and they ask him a question, seeking to challenge his authority. Tell us, by what authority you are doing these things? Who gave you this authority? And in so many ways, this is an utterly absurd question. Particularly from these guys. The leaders, the ones who knew the scriptures, who should have known far better. I mean, by this stage in Jesus' ministry, it should have been obvious where his authority came from. I mean, Luke's purpose in our reading his gospel, remember chapter 1, verse 4, is that we might be certain of who Jesus is and why he has come. And Luke's kind of laid out the evidence for us that we might see that Jesus is God's king with all authority. And it's the same evidence that the leaders, the priests, have also seen. I was reading Luke this week with someone and they asked this brilliant question. They asked, why are the Pharisees and the leaders always there, always questioning? They seem to be everywhere. You know, reread Luke and you see the leaders were present throughout Jesus' ministry, continually opposing him. That they knew what he had done. They knew what he had been teaching. And Jesus' authority had been clearly attested to. You know, beginning with John the Baptist. who proclaimed the Messiah was coming and had arrived, just as the Old Testament prophets had foretold, Isaiah 40, Malachi 4. Then there was Jesus' baptism, Luke 3. Skies open, God himself speaks, "You are my son, whom I love. With you I'm well pleased." And then Jesus has healed people, he's raised people from the dead, he's calmed storms, he's driven out demons, just as Isaiah 61 had foretold, and Jesus has spoken of in Luke 4. I mean, he'd fed 5,000 people just as God had done in Exodus. He taught in a way that no one else had done so previously, with such understanding of the scriptures, such that at this stage, and for these guys who knew the prophecy, there should have been no doubt. They should have been as certain as one could be of who Jesus is and why he has come to save and to restore and whose authority he came with. And instead they ask this absurd question. "Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things?" No wonder Jesus wept as he came into Jerusalem, weeping at the hardness of their hearts and the blindness whilst the evidence stood before them. And so Jesus asked them a question. "Tell me, John's baptism, was it from heaven or of human origin?" And Jesus is not, you know, dodging the question. He's not playing the political leader game, kind of not answer the question, ask something else. No, he's raising the stakes. If the leadership wants to deal with Jesus, they must also deal with John the Baptist. Either John is from God or he's not. Either one must respond to John because he was from God, or ignore him. Which is it? And the question is crucial, because John pointed to Jesus and pointed to Jesus' office and authority that he claims to be God's king. And Jesus affirmed John, accepting baptism from him. Their ministries are linked, they're bound together. The answer to Jesus' question is the answer to their question. Verse 5, look what they do. They discuss. They reason. And their conference discussion reveals their hypocrisy. It begins to expose their hearts. If we say he's from heaven, he'll ask, "Well, why didn't you believe in him?" And if we say of human origin, well, the people will stone us because they're persuaded, they're certain John's a prophet. And to call a true prophet false was such a serious thing under Old Testament law, you were stoned for it. Hence their fear. And so they answer, "We don't know where it was from." And their refusal to answer is an indictment on them, especially in light of the office that they hold as the leaders of God's people, the shepherds of the flock. What they can't tell between a true and a false prophet, that they can't discern. If they're incompetent to judge John, how can they hope to be competent to judge Jesus? And so Jesus does not need to answer. Oh, he will do, verses 41 to 44, a little bit later on, and at his trial, but for now he does not. But his question to them has exposed their hearts. They're more concerned with their political standing, with keeping office, with their wealth and their status and their lifestyle, than they are with the truth. They'd rather look ignorant than admit that John was of God, and in turn, Jesus, and so had their world turned upside down and have to submit to Jesus' authority. And so lose their position and status and their wealth and the way they do things and all they'd built and all the power they had. And here's the thing. The fear of giving up our authority, our control over our lives and what it brings us, often blinds us from submitting and following Jesus and submitting to his authority. When I was 12, 13, I remember being in Sunday school. I was down in the basement of the church. It had no windows. There was junk at the back. And the teacher, Don, asked at the end of this particular lesson, he asked if anyone would like to commit their lives to Jesus, to be saved, to pray the prayer. And then you had your name written on a bell that was then put up on the wall. I don't know why that was the case, but it was. And I remember wanting to go forward. And I did. And kneeling with my brother next to me, we prayed this prayer as Don led us. And then being told, look, you're a Christian now. But instead of feeling elated, instead of feeling peace, instead of being joyful, I was overwhelmed with fear, panic even. I remember getting home and going to my bedroom in tears. Not tears of joy, but tears of absolute fear. Because I didn't like the idea that I was relinquishing control of my life to Jesus. I understood who Jesus was. I understood, as far as I remember, the cross and salvation. I was certain Jesus was who he said he was, but I was scared. I was scared to give up control. I was scared in my mind to have this God and suddenly be like a puppet on strings and not be able to be in charge and do what I want to do. And this thought of authority over me and to relinquish that to him panicked me. And my father came to me and he said, it's okay. If you're not ready, God will understand. And it was with that I could continue. As if I took back that prayer, I knew I wasn't a Christian. In God's grace, he didn't let me go. And finally, 12 years later, after other moments of prayer, I would finally fully submit every area of my life to him and baptize. But oh, I wish I'd done it earlier. But in God's grace, he kindly brought me to him. But that fear of relinquishing control, of giving up my authority to rule my life, caused me to be blind to who Jesus really was. Caused me to be blind to his love and goodness and to what he was offering, that which was far better. And these leaders are exactly the same. They fail to see who Jesus truly is and what he had to offer and what he was offering them. Seeking to guide their own lives, just wanting to hang on there. For what? A little more wealth now? A little more control, a little more status, a little more prestige. As I say to the kids, when your kids do this, they drive past a big house, say, oh, I wish we could live in a bigger house with a swimming pool and, you know, 16 bedrooms and have a bigger car and a flashier car and have multiple cars. And I say to them, you know, look, guys, wealth now, control of your life now, status, prestige, all of that that's attached to that. It's like a grain of sand on a beach. We're to follow Jesus, to give him control, submit to his authority, is to have the whole beach for eternity. What would you rather have? If you only knew, says Jesus, what I bring, what I offer, you would willingly submit to me and my authority, certain who I am, certain of what I give. Peace with God, eternity with him, treated as a child of his. And so often, even as believers, we have those moments when we don't want to submit to his authority. We challenge it, we question it. We would rather do things our way. You know, we fear that truly following Jesus wholeheartedly might mean, what it might bring. And so we challenge and we push back. And yet, friend, what is there to fear? Jesus proclaims good news. He died for us, he saved us. Why would you not trust him each and every day with your whole life, every aspect of your life, with your kids and your wealth and your job and your family and what you do in church and submitting fully to his authority rather than seeking to try to hold on to ultimately that which will not last? And the leaders kept hanging on, wanted to be in control, wanted the authority in their own right. And Jesus tells them in the crowd a parable that reveals that his authority demands a response. Have a look. See, so often people think, oh, well, I'll reject Jesus, so what? I mean, the leaders are only concerned for them. Now, they don't see the consequences, and yet Jesus lovingly, graciously points it out. He doesn't just let them think it's okay to not acknowledge or to not recognize his authority. He tells them a parable. He says there was a man who planted a vineyard. He rented it to some farmers. It was a fairly common business relationship in those days whereby farmers would work the land, care for it, pay the rent, along with some of the fruit from the labors. When the owner had gone away a long time, verse 9, he sent a servant to collect the rent he was owed, and the tenants beat him, sent him away empty-handed. And we're not told why they did so, but presumably they thought that the owner had been away so long that they could assert themselves as the owners in effect. And the owner responds with amazing patience. He sends a second, then a third servant, each equally treated badly, with things escalating. They were beaten and treated shamefully and wounded and sent on their way, at which point the owner decides to send his beloved son, in the hope that they might show him more respect than they'd shown the servants. The tenants see the son coming and they have a little discussion. They think, do you know what, if we kill the son, the inheritance will be ours. Now, I don't know what planet they were on, because wherever does the murderer receive the inheritance? But maybe they thought, well, you know, the owner has died, and so if we kill the son, well, no one will know, and we can assert squatter rights and we can become the owner. Or maybe they thought the owner was so weak, it doesn't matter. Even if we kill the son, he's not going to come and do anything to us. But it was a drastic miscalculation. No, they thought the owner was weak and feeble and dead even. How wrong they were. Because have a look, verse 16. For the owner comes and kills those tenants. And he gives the vineyard to others. And the immediate response of the crowd, verse 16, and the leaders, verse 19, shows that the meaning of the parable was transparent to them. The vineyard was an Old Testament imagery often used of Israel. Tenants are the leaders, those responsible for tending and caring for the vineyard to produce spiritual fruit. Servants sent to collect the rent are the prophets who called on the people of Israel to produce the obedience and justice and worship owed to the Lord. The people of Israel, though, under the leaders, systematically mistreated God's prophets. Isaiah was reportedly sawn in two. Jeremiah was locked in stocks and put in prison and dangled up to his armpits in a cesspit. Micaiah was imprisoned and starved. Hananiah was imprisoned and put in stocks. Zechariah was stoned in the temple courts. Uriah was struck down by the king. And in just a few short days, the current Israelite generation would make matters worse by killing God's son. And when the people heard this, they said, no, God forbid. God forbid, verse 16. We'd never do that. That would never happen. Verse 17, Jesus looks at them directly and he asks them, what is the meaning of that which is written? And he quotes Psalm 118, verse 22, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. For the stone, Jesus, will be rejected and killed by the leaders and the people, but he will also be exalted. He'll be lifted up to become the foundation, the chief cornerstone, the most important stone on which God would build his church. And that same stone will then be a stone of judgment, verse 18. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces. Anyone whom it falls will be crushed. They'll be destroyed. They'll be removed. Now, primarily, as verse 19 makes clear, Jesus' words are aimed at the leaders, those who clearly rejected his authority, refused to submit to it, who were planning his death. And Jesus is warning them. He's saying, look, guys, if you reject me, if you reject my authority, it's dangerous. It will result in the removal from office, that the vineyard be taken away from you. It will result in your death. You will be killed. And you will face my ultimate authority, judgment, an eternal separation from him and hell. His authority demands a response. You can't just neglect it. You can't just say, I don't know. He's warning them. But of course, it doesn't just apply to them. Because in 1 Peter chapter 2, the same verse, Psalm 118 verse 22, is used and applied to all who reject Jesus, who reject his authority as God's king. They'll face the same outcome, to come under his judgment, to have the stone fall on them. See, don't miss the warning. The one who is the stone, the one that is rejected, will become the cornerstone, the chief stone. He will be exalted, lifted high. Philippians 2, every knee will bow, willingly, forcibly, but every knee will bow, including yours. And so if you have not yet submitted to the authority of Jesus as King, as the Lord, as the one who can bring peace, as the one who can restore you to God and forgive your sins, then do so this morning. Do it before it's too late. Submit to his authority, his loving, gracious, kind authority. What's holding you back? If you're a believer here this morning, hear the warning to us. See, because of the Jewish rejection, the vineyard has been given to the church. We now have the privilege of being God's people and the responsibility to live as such, submitting ourselves to Jesus' authority in every aspect of our lives. We might not be Jewish leaders. We might not be outrightly rejecting the Son in the same manner, as it were. But the heart issue that drove the leaders to reject Christ's authority is the same heart issue that you and I battle with every single day. See, fundamentally, what's the heart issue? What's behind all of their actions? They desire to be the owner rather than the tenant. They desire to be the owner rather than the tenant. They thought they were in charge. They thought they had the authority. They thought they could do things their way, make up the rules. And they literally did. I mean, in the temple became their place with their rules, with no real regard to God and his purposes and his ways and his commands and his decrees. That's why Jesus went in driving out the sellers and teaching the people the truth. They've made up their own rules. They decreed how they wanted to worship God. They thought they were owners, not tenants. And the reality is, this has always been the battle of our hearts from Genesis 3, that we think we're in charge, that we somehow think that we have all authority, that we can determine all the rules on how we live, and we can determine how we will worship God, and we'll do things our way, and we will live how we want to live. I mean, it's the adage of our day, determine what you want to be. You're in charge. Be who you want to be. It goes back to what we saw earlier, isn't it? This fear to give up control. Why? Because we think we're the owners. We act as if we're the creator. We act as if we're the king, rather than the created, the subject, the tenant. And for most of us here, we're not blatantly rejecting Jesus' authority. But it's expressed often in the thousand little decisions we make every single day. Well, I want to keep being the one who's an owner and make up the rules. Last week we were on holiday, as you know, and we're in the car and I'm driving, and I needed to turn right to get to the petrol station, which was literally just 20 yards there. And yet there's a sign that says quite clearly, no right turn. But I look down the road to the left and I see traffic and no obvious place to turn around. And whilst I look, the traffic's at a standstill and there's a gap before me. There's nothing coming in the other way. And so I do the right-hand turn, straight across the busy road and straight into the petrol station. Of course, I was immediately told of my sin and my wrongdoing by all members of my family. And they were right. But you see, what happened at that little moment? At that one little moment, that little decision, just one in a thousand of that day, I decided to be the owner, not the tenant. That I was the one with the authority. Me, King Mark of the S-Max. And I decided that I would serve my own purposes. I'd disobey the rules of the road and do what I want to do. Oh, you say, but that's not direct disobedience to Jesus' authority. Well, it is, because Jesus' word is clear. Submit to those in governing authority over you, Romans 13. And I decided at that point the road rules don't apply to me. Which in turn I decided that actually God's rule about submitting to authority at that point doesn't apply to me. Because I'm the king. I act as an owner, not a tenant. I was writing the rules. I was doing what I wanted to do. Which is exactly what the leaders were doing. Making up the rules. Challenging Jesus' authority. And every little decision I make will reflect whether I'm determined to be an owner or a tenant, the king or the subject, opposing or submitting to Jesus' authority. And the warning of this passage is clear. If I continually set myself up to oppose the authority of Jesus, if I do not determine in my heart, with the help of God's Spirit, to nail to the mast, as it were, every single day, Jesus is king, his authority is over every aspect of my life, then I will end up in the same position as those leaders. That's the movement. That's the trend. Such that ultimately I will be rejected, for I will have rejected him. I'd have chosen to go my own way again. See, hear the warning. God has given us much that we might serve him. His Son who saved us has restored us to relationship with him. He's given us gifts and skills and wisdom that we might serve him. And in all that we do, bring him glory. That in every detail of our life, we might be bringing the fruit of obedience and worship before him. But we must do so seeking to submit to Jesus' authority. His authority demands a response. You can't get away with, I don't know. How will you respond? What will it look like in your life, in the decisions you make this week?